Good morning. I've been working on my modeling skills. Do you like it? Yeah. Thanks. You guys are like, he's lying. Yes, I am. Good to see you. Glad you're here. Everybody smiling? Who's got like a little bit of candy hangover going on? Just curious. Let's see. Be honest. Thank you. One honest soul in the room today, right? Who's got some baseball who watched baseball last night? I'm just curious. All right. Just checking. Football people yesterday? Beaver fans are excited. Undefeated in the Pac-12, whatever it is, right? Woo! That's good. There you go. All right. Well, our journey has been the same, and just giving you a quick update, Tucker continues to make progress. When we look at it a day to day, it's hard to see, but when we look at it kind of week to week, we see quite a lot of progress. They're telling us probably another 4 weeks or so in rehab, and so you've never wanted to get out of that place bad enough, you know what I mean? There is a thing called hospital delirium. It's a real thing. We might be on the verge of that. And so, just so you know, but he makes progress and we see progress. It's hard to see sometimes because it's so painful and hard to watch, right? Learning how to do bed transfers from the bed to the wheelchair or the wheelchair to a stool. And you know, our legs normally just work. And so when they're not working, it's quite the thing to see. And so continue to pray for him. He's strong. They love him up there because he's a hard worker. He's got that attitude of, I'm just going to grind it out. And so they like to put him in the room with other young people who don't have that motivation. And he just kind of tells them, get over it. Quit crying. Get to work, right? And I think they like that because they can't say that. But anyway, last week, Dr. Mark Zies was here. And he talked about Jeremiah chapter 32, and I loved his introduction when he showed the two pictures of the fish, by the way. I thought that was a great way to, introduce himself. But if you remember in chapter 32, the city of Jerusalem is surrounded by Babylon, and the people, they are scared. I mean, they're scared. A famine is approaching as food's going to run out. The once great kingdom that everybody knew about was about to fall apart. And Jeremiah is in prison. And because the king didn't like what he had to say, he just locks him up and says, you stay there. And so it kind of feels like this hopeless situation, like everything's over. It's a little bit bleak. It's a little bit broken. And yet God tells Jeremiah, hey, why don't you go buy a piece of property? And you get to that chapter and you think, whoa. But if you know anything about God, God doesn't go with the flow. And often, if you're being invited into something that's not with the flow, it's normally, I think, you can make a good assumption that God's inviting you into it. Because we need to understand that God doesn't move with the flow. God doesn't work in conventional, traditional ways like we think he does. Nobody would buy land in a war zone. Nobody would do that. Nobody would invest in property knowing that it was going to be invaded and destroyed. And so the command, go buy property, makes no sense at all unless our hope is actually in God. That's the deal. Jeremiah 32 wasn't about land. Jeremiah 32 was about hope. And it's really a two-part series here in the middle of our big series in Jeremiah. Hope, today is trust, because if you don't have hope, we might as well not talk about trust. And I believe it comes that way. And so last week was part one in hope. But before we move on, I want to make something really, really clear to us, especially if we want to run with horses. If we want to run with the horses like Jeremiah is challenging us to do, I need us to understand something that's mission critical. This is not our home. I need us to understand that. Your house, yes, is a home on earth, but it's not your home. It's not my home. Gresham, Oregon is not my home. this earth is not my home. Does that make sense? It's not my home. As a matter of fact, both the Old Testament and the New Testament both teach us that Christians, as Christians, we are foreigners, we are aliens, we are strangers, we are sojourners, we are migrants and refugees on this earth because earth is not home. It's not home. And in 1993, God invited me to purchase some land in another land. In 1993, God invited me to be a part of His kingdom, and I placed my citizenship. For me, it was a defining day, September 5th, 1993. It was a defining day, the day I was baptized and I chose to follow Jesus. I purchased a piece of property in a kingdom that I have citizenship in, declaring that I am not home. This is not my home. And what it means, no matter what happens, and no matter how bad my circumstances may be, no matter how bad the struggles are, no matter what might be done to me, I have property in God's kingdom, and remembering this is what gives me hope. Because I don't know how long I have on earth. Some say I'm halfway. Some of you are a lot closer. Some of you are a lot further. But I know most of us don't make it past 120. It's not my home. And so when I'm facing challenging, difficult times, having that piece of property in a land that I do belong in gives me hope. Because I have a home. And we sing hymns and choruses and praise songs about it all the time. We talk about it nearly at every memorial service. And yet we throw in the towel and we grumble and we complain. We whine and we isolate ourselves when things don't go the way I think they should go. This year, for us, has been no different in the difficulty we face. Just isn't. I mean, it feels a little bit more than usual. At the first of the year, Sarah was diagnosed with a brain tumor behind her left eye, right? A meningioma, just a little floating tumor in between the brain and the skull, right? So our attention has been on that. And then Tucker's injury, which we're not really thinking about Sarah's stuff right now because... And you know what keeps me going? This isn't home. It's not home. And I don't want to sound like a fatalist here, but Sarah, a tumor may take my wife out. And my son may be wheelchair bound. And I'm going to be okay. You know why? Because this isn't home. This is not home. I have property in the kingdom of God where my citizenship resides, where everything wrong will be made right. That's my home. And so that's hope. And I hope you grasp this reality because that's the hope we have, and nobody can take that from you. Nobody can destroy it. It's a hope. And so now that we've talked about hope again, as a reminder from last week, let's talk about trust amidst adversity. Let us have an unwavering faith and a dependence on God that can't be shaken, that can't be taken. And so last week, I loved Mark Zies used the phrase faithful defiance. I thought that was a brilliant phrase. Here's another term for you this week. It's fragmented culture. Fragmented culture. I don't know if you know this or not, but Jeremiah lived in what we would call a fragmented culture. Judah had been had really been a complete and whole culture. Most people lived in unity. Most people agreed on things. Most people were aligned with God's vision and what God wanted for them. Most people agreed what was right and what was wrong, the purpose of life and what society should look like. But that wasn't the way it was going to be anymore. Sound familiar? It should. Because in Jeremiah's time, there were kings who used power in radically different ways. People were fighting with each other. Nobody seemed to agree on what was right or wrong. People weren't aligned on some of the major issues. And sort of how we're living in this culture right now, very fragmented. You don't have to go far. And you can drop a golden nugget phrase and you could ignite a conversation that could blow fireworks far into the sky. You know what they are. I know what they are. Fragmented. And maybe this is one of the reasons I've enjoyed Jeremiah so much, because it looks a lot like how we're living today. The prophet was in a very similar situation, or we are in a very similar situation to what the prophet was in. And in fragmented culture, anything anybody says can be right, or if you don't like it, it could be wrong. Whatever you feel. And so we say things, what is truth anyway? We talk about relative absolutes, or some might argue that there are real no answers to some of the greatest challenges that we face. And Jeremiah would say, that's not true. This isn't so. And Jeremiah gives us a picture, actually, a picture of two very different trees. And so as I read these verses, you will follow along. You'll recognize that although Jeremiah is talking about trees, really what he's talking about is our hearts. And so this is what it says in Jeremiah chapter 17. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man. There it is. And makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He is like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness, in an uninhabited salt land. But blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord, because he is like a tree planted by water that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear where heat comes from, or when heat comes, for it leaves remain green and is not anxious in the year of the drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. And so do you see, although Jeremiah is talking about trees here, really what he's talking about is the heart. And I love what Tim Keller does with this particular passage, because he says the word roots actually is a beautiful word. The word root in Latin is where we get the word radix, which is where we get our English word radical. And so he's like, those roots are like radical. And I like how this plays out. Since we too live in this fragmented culture that we're talking about, we've been invited to run with horses. We need to know a few realities about our own heart. And I think most of us know these, but I just want to remind us today. Because I think Jeremiah is pointing out a significant truth to us. In these verses, Jeremiah makes it known that every human heart actually trusts something. We have to believe this. Because if we look at verses 5 through 8 again, it says, the man trusts in the Lord, right, is like someone who puts his roots in water. This is a person who puts their heart, their trust in the Lord, in God. And what's amazing about this is that the main characteristic of the heart of someone who turns away from the trust of God is still actually trust, because you're trusting in something. And to me, this is wild, because the person who puts their heart in God and the person who doesn't put their trust in God, their heart in God, puts their heart in something. Does that make sense? Both have one thing in common, and it's radical trust. It's this root trust. And the common characteristic in the person who believes in God and the person who doesn't believe in God is still trust. At the heart, the basics of every heart, of every single life, is some sort of radical trust. I've sat with people who say it doesn't matter what you believe about God. Or I'm not committed to a particular view, or I'm open to many ways to God, or it doesn't matter really what you believe about God, just be a good person. Or people who say even if there is a God, it doesn't matter what you believe, we all have to think for ourselves about truth anyway. Or people who say nobody can tell us what's right, wrong, or true, or right for me, think for yourself. Or people who say faith is a crutch. According to Jeremiah, the people who say those things actually still have trust. They have trust in something else than God. I've talked about one of our greatest challenges in our culture. Individualism and autonomy. Right? And so we say things like, well, you got to think for yourself, and you've got to work for yourself, and you've got to build what you want. We're not actually thinking for ourselves if we think those things. Do we understand that? We've actually put our trust in something. It's a particular way of thinking. As a matter of fact, it's a Western tribal way of life that was based on the Enlightenment period, not God. In other words, our trust isn't in God. It's the way of thinking that we've put our trust in. Jeremiah is making it known that we all, if we are human, have hearts, we are spiritual, we have thoughts, we have decisions. We have ideas about human nature. We have ideals about what's right and what's wrong, about knowledge. Nobody can avoid these things. We're going to either be a tree planted in the streams. And when the drought comes and the heat comes, we're going to be okay. Or we are going to be planted somewhere out in the middle where the water is shallow. And when the heat comes, we'll dry up. And when drought comes, we'll dry up. And we get to decide which one we're going to be. Listen, every statement of God, whether belief or doubt, is a statement of trust. It is. In faith and trust, every person in their heart is committed to some view about God, some view about spirituality. And I think what Jeremiah is saying is you might be Christian, you might be Jew, you might be atheist, agnostic, secular, or Muslim, whatever you are, it's going to require radical trust in something or someone. We have this in common. Every human being that you encounter, Christian or not, has put their trust, radical trust, in something. They are planted somewhere. Does that make sense? We have this in common. And the reality should force me to ask and answer, then where is my trust? Or who do I trust in? If not God, what requires as much trust to trust in what or who I'm trusting in? I know that was a big sentence. And so there's something else Jeremiah needs us to know. Look at this, verse 9. He says, the heart is deceitful above all things. The heart is desperately sick. Who can understand it? Anybody want to try to understand your own heart? Right? Paul said this, why do I do the things I don't want to do? Why do I keep going back to the things I know aren't good for me? The heart is deceitful. It's sick. Who can understand it? And it says this, I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. And if you didn't get this, let me just be very clear. Our heart is sick. There's something wrong. Our hearts are continually, will put itself in the wrong things at the wrong time. We'll put our hearts into the things that actually can't sustain us, that can't support us, that can't help, that will actually suck life from us instead of give us life, that will actually drain us instead of sustain us. And so not only is there radical trust, but there's a radical defect. We have a problem. And the defect is that every human heart will put trust somewhere. Every human heart. Can you think for your own life where you've put your trust, if it wasn't God, and it failed you? Anybody? Am I the only one? Just me and you again? Oh, thank you. One of us. I like your role. Your row right there. Right? Have we ever put our heart in the wrong thing? And it let us down. We're shocked. We're appalled. Our hearts take root and our hearts draw from the soil, from the ground, from the water source. And if God is not the center of our lives, then something is the center of our lives. I need us to understand that. Whatever else our heart is rooted in, we will drink from it. And we drink from it. We look for our significance and our security and our purpose and our meaning with the same intensity that it would be if we were actually connected to God. And every human puts their roots down into something, and if God is not our radical trust, then we will look for to love, we'll look to success, we'll look to our looks, we'll look to our family, our career, our achievement, and we'll look for those things to put our roots down into. I've never had the problem with my looks, right? But I know people who have, and guess what happens? We all get closer to halfway. I won't go further. Anyway, whatever it is, we will be putting roots down into, and we're going to look for that thing to give us our significance and that thing to give us our security and our purpose and our meaning. And I'm telling you, all of those things will fail us. And here's the problem, because eventually our careers end, don't they? And there are people in our church, I've had conversations with you who really believe your life is just over and you'd rather just die because you were something when you were somebody in your career. But now that the career is over, you feel like nobody. Your root was in your career. Or our families. How about our families? Like, we put all of our hope and all of our trust in our families. And families are good things, but guess what? Families divide. I guarantee you, as all of you are thinking about Thanksgiving coming up, there's somebody in your family you're wondering if you should invite or not. Because families disappoint us. Maybe you're the one they're having the conversation about. It might be you. But divorce happens. The kid starts dating a girl we don't like. The brother-in-law. Right? If our hope and our trust is in our families, then guess what? At some point, something's going to happen and things are going to fall apart. Maybe it's our looks. But there's this thing called collagen. It changes. So we buy powder to help it. Right? Our hair changes colors or disappears. And then reappears in really strange places. Our bone structures weaken. My point is this. If God is not our trust, whatever our heart is planted in, if not God, is going to leave you, let you down, abandon you, and when the heat comes, you are going to dry up and fall apart. Verse 6 says this, "He is like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness in an uninhabited salt land." If that's our trust, and our trust is in anything besides God, that's our outcome. That's what will happen. And man, our country is filled with people who say, "I trust in God, but he let me down." I have conversations with people all the time. I once used to be a part of a church. I used to believe in God, but then God let me down. And I want to tell you what they're really saying, because what they're really saying is that they mean that they trusted God for something that their real trust was actually in, but then God didn't give them that something, therefore they didn't trust in God. We do this all the time. I expect God to do X, Y, and Z in my life because my trust is actually in the X, Y, and Z. Does that make sense? So then when God doesn't do that for me, who am I mad at? I'm mad at God. But I wasn't planted in the streams, near the streams that give life. I was planted in the things that are in an uninhabited land, that are going to dry me up, that are going to suck life from me. It's absolutely possible to trust God and not make God the trust of our hearts. Verse 12 says this, "A glorious throne set on high from the beginning is the place of our sanctuary. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you shall be put to shame. And those who turn away from you shall be written in the earth, for they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living water." Here's my challenge with all of this. I don't know if you know this or not, but trees can't plant themselves. Did you know that? And this is actually one of the fundamental reasons people have a hard time with Christianity, because who has to plant us? I'm going to help you. God does. And we have to surrender. It's kind of the first act. And the surrender part is hard. And if we want to be planted, someone has to dig us up where we currently are planted. Trees have to be transplanted. There has to be an intervention because our roots are in something else. Our roots are already in something, and this is the defect. We always put our roots down in something that cannot support us and give us an abundant life. They will lie to us, they will leave us, they will abandon us, and they will fail us. And so I want to share some good news, because trees can't replant themselves. There is something on the outside that has to come in, dig down deep into the root system from the bottom, and pull me up out from the roots and transform me. It's called radical transformation. And this is an important part, because we want this radical transformation in our lives. Let me tell you how we get it. And I think there's two very clear things that have to happen if we want to be transformed. And I love that Jeremiah tells us in chapter 17, verse 14, it says, "Heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for you are my praise." And so I think there's two very clear things here. First, we have to ask God to heal us. We have to ask God to heal us. I've been asking for a lot of healing lately. And we have to ask for healing. We ask for healing when we know something terrible is happening. And we ask for healing maybe as we see death approaching. Without any intervention, it kind of feels like life is over. So we ask for healing when our bodies are broken, or when we have poison in our bodies. We plead with God and we ask God, please heal. And I think if we want transformation, if we want God in our lives, then we have to cry out, God, the things my heart are planted in, the things that I'm currently rooted in, they're taking life from me, they're drying me up, and I'm thirsty, and I'm parched, and I'm dry, and these things are not giving me life, and they are not sustaining me, and I'm in the desert, and I'm thirsty, and nothing is helping. Help, God, heal me. I need to be replanted. Heal me. We have to admit that there is something wrong with where we are planted. The problem is, we're not very good at admitting that there's something wrong, are we? Because we look to the guy next to us and say, man, I'm doing better than he is. And as long as I'm doing better than he is, then why do I need help? He's the one who needs help. But I promise you, all of us probably have some roots in some things that are not giving us life. And our pride says, don't acknowledge it. Don't say it. But Jeremiah says, you know what you want to do? You know what you need to do? If you want transformation, you know what you need to do? You need to say, God, heal me. And then what else? God, save me. I love this verse. It's becoming maybe one of my favorite verses in Jeremiah. But so is chapter 12 and chapter 1 and some others. I love Jeremiah's confidence. Heal me, O Lord, and I will be healed. Save me, Lord, and I will be saved. There's this confidence in this. Jeremiah is not declaring, hey, God, if you've got some chance and some time and if you've got some willingness, could you come over here? And he's like, no. I'm saying, God, heal me, and I'm believing God is going to heal. He says, save me, and I believe God is going to save. I love the confidence. To the degree we grasp what Jesus has done for us, we call it the gospel. That's what we call it. And the more we see that Jesus went to the desert to get us out of the desert, and the more we see what Jesus did for us, the more it will begin to transform us, and the more willing we will be to say, heal me and save me, move me from these things that are taking life from me, and plant me near the streams that give me life. When we see what Jesus was willing to do for us, I love Paul. Paul says he had a thorn in his flesh, right? A thorn in his side. And he asked God over and over and over, remove this thorn from me. And God said, hold on, Paul. My grace is sufficient for you. And Paul says, whoa, okay. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul was asking God to change his circumstances, and God reminded Paul that the weaker he was, the more dependent he was going to be upon God, and he would become more and more dependent and used by God in the process. In Acts 26, Paul was a slave in chains, standing in front of Agrippa and this guy named Festus, and he didn't envy their position, he didn't envy their money, he didn't envy their power or their freedom. He was not going to be a victim of circumstances. If our roots are deep into God, it won't matter what our circumstances are or how much heat we endure. If we are rooted in the life-giving streams that only God provides, we won't dry up. I love the conversation that Jesus has with the woman at the well. Jesus said something similar to Jeremiah. Hey, lady, don't you know everybody drinks? Everybody drinks water. Jeremiah says everybody trusts in something, right? But then Jesus told the woman at the well, he says, listen, everyone who drinks of this water, they won't thirst anymore. They won't be thirsty anymore, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give them, they will never be thirsty. But he reminded her that if she drinks from just water that's not his, she will be thirsty again. Jesus said, the water that I give will become in the person a spring of water welling up. Man, I hope that your hope isn't in this land, but it's in your future home. And I hope your trust, your roots are planted deep near the streams that give life. If you're not, then like Jeremiah, you have to cry out, heal me, save me, expecting God to come in and to dig the root ball and to pull us up out and to plant us again in a better place. So let me talk about one thing real quick that's very much with this thinking, but it's an invitation. On the 23rd, we're going to have what we call Baptism Sunday. And it's an invitation for you to participate. We want to make sure that we put this out there a couple different times a year. One, because we've kind of turned our whole gathering into a time to celebrate this. But the most meaningful act demonstrating a new believer that a new believer has accepted, who has kind of called and said, God, heal me and save me, a willingness to abandon their old ways of life and start this new way of life in Jesus is really through the practice of baptism. I think baptism is one of the most beautiful public commitments that we can do as our desire to follow Jesus increases. Jesus instructed us to be baptized. Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost, said to do this. And so that's why we do it. That's why we make it happen. I think it's a simple step of obedience, saying, God, I'm going to declare that I am going to live for you, that you are my king, and that my citizenship and my home isn't in this place, but in another place and another land. And then I think Jesus modeled this for us. He did it. I don't think Jesus needed to get baptized, but he told John the Baptist, hey, do this for me. And so we practice it the way Jesus did it. All right, I know a lot of us come from a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different faith journeys. And that's part of what the Restoration Movement is about. We want you here because we believe that we can find unity in all things. We really do. But we practice immersion. We dunk. That's what baptism means, to dunk. Jesus was dunked. I still think we kind of do it wrong. We kind of lay you back nice and easy. I think we should like whoosh. But that's my opinion, all right? And so I know this to be true, because we've had conversations, that God has been inviting some of you to take this step. And he's inviting you to come be a part of his forever family. And this is something that we get to do. Mark chapter 1, verse 9 says, at the time Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee, and he was baptized by John in the Jordan River. Jesus said in Matthew 28, go and make disciples of all nations and baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. In Acts chapter 18, verse 8, and many who heard him believed. And when they believed, guess what they did? They were baptized. Luke chapter 6, verse 46. Jesus asked his disciples, why do you call me Lord? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do what I say? Romans 6, 4 says, we were buried therefore with him by baptism into death. And I love this. In order that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in the newness of life. I think for me, the greatest piece of being baptized and what it means for me is it's the one thing that makes me like Jesus in experiencing the death, the burial, and the resurrection. Paul says, I want to know Christ. I want to know the power of his resurrection. And the one symbolic act that we have to participate is to be buried and to be risen. And so I just want to invite you, if you've been thinking about this, we'd love to have a conversation with you about what it means. And so I think there's a QR code. Is there a QR code on there? Perfect. There's a QR code. You can take a screenshot of that. You can register and you can participate with us on the 23rd. Does that sound all right? If you know someone and you've been wanting to have this conversation with someone, I've just empowered you. Go. And share about Jesus and invite them to take that step. Cool. We're going to move to our time of communion. As I was thinking about this message, this is what I thought about. On the cross, Jesus said, I'm thirsty. And yet Jesus was able to withstand circumstances. He was able to withstand the heat. And yet in a lot of ways, Jesus died of thirst. And as I've been wrestling with that this week, and I've been thinking about that this week, I recognize that he died of thirst so that I would never be thirsty. Jesus, in a lot of ways, was uprooted from all of the life he had. And he was placed here on earth. And then on earth, he was uprooted again and he hung on a tree. You know why? So that I could be planted in God near the streams that give life. And so my encouragement to you is this: as you eat the bread and you drink the juice today, understand that he was broken so that we could be made whole. He was poured out so that we can be cleansed. Everything Jesus did, we call it the gospel. Everything he did was so that we wouldn't have to, or so that we could. So eat the bread, drink the juice, and remember, he was broken so you could be whole. He was poured out so you could be cleansed. There's a table back here, one up in the balcony, one over here, one over here. Really ask yourself, where is my trust? Who or what is my trust in? If not God, who or what? And is it worth it? You're free to go.